This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe and to welcome to Santa Fe Paula Francis and Ginny Sassaman. They are co-founders of Gross National Happiness USA. Paula calls herself a happiness walker. We'll find out what that is in a few minutes. Ginny's also a happiness walker, activist, writer, teacher, and they are walking across the United States for happiness. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So what does that mean?
To be a happiness walker.
Yeah.
Well, just that. This is a project of an organization called Gross National Happiness USA. And this is an 8,000-mile walk around the country. It's a research project to talk to people along the way about happiness and what truly matters in life.
And this is something, when I found out you were doing this, the first thing I thought of was a woman named Peace Pilgrim, who I guess you guys didn't know personally, but knew of her work.
Oh, I wish I knew her personally. That would have been a great honor. But I had read her book maybe 15 or more years ago and was just inspired by this woman who literally walked her talk. And she was very passionate about peace, non-nuclear proliferation, and which is why she originally started walking. And I thought, boy, to be a person that really has that kind of conviction, she must be someone awfully special. And I am thrilled that I have made connections with people along the way who have actually met her and housed her and been part of an ongoing organization, Friends of Peace Pilgrim, to keep her legacy alive, which we need to do because, you know, we could use more people like her.
Well, what so struck me about her when I read her book, and this was when I was in my 20s and sort of devouring everything, she was somebody who gave up everything, including her name. And she had a tunic that said Peace Pilgrim on it. And she had a pencil, a notebook, and a toothbrush. I'll never forget that. And she started her little sneakers, and she started walking across the country for nuclear disarmament. But it was kind of like a spiritual offering of some kind, where she slept where nature or people allowed her to and ate what was offered to her, and that was it.
That's right. What a way to live, right? You know?
for everybody, for sure.
Well, this walk is not exactly like that.
No, I'm looking at some backpacks here in the corner.
And we have a lot more comforts along the way, but we have given up a lot of our lives and made some sacrifices not like her. I mean, she's quite a special person, but we have made many, many changes in our lives to accommodate this walk because we're so passionate about it ourselves. And we're finding that the information, the stories, all of that are really amazing. And we're using all of this information for a purpose related to our organization. We can get to maybe in a little bit, but it's the connection to people along the way that makes this a really profound journey. And we're finding that people really want to tell their stories. People really want to be heard. And I think that's what Peace Pilgrim did too.
Yeah.
You know, she had a message that she was giving out about peace and connection and all of that. But I think it is those, what Ginny and I like to call microbursts of love that happen with every meeting. You have that very instant, strong connection with folks, and that has kept us walking.
I would say also, it is for us very much a spiritual journey. I think for both Paul and me, and there are other people who are involved along the way, it is our calling. We wear vests that say serious about happiness because we are. We're serious in our hearts, in our souls, because this is our life's purpose. We're also serious in very practical ways, in that there are changes we would really like to see happen on a societal level. So it's multi-layered for us. It's not just our own spiritual journeys, but it's also our activism, our commitment to trying to make this a better planet. And of course, unlike Peace Pilgrim, we carry cell phones.
Right.
So we can text.
She might have two.
She probably would have if she were doing this now.
And, you know, there are times we don't know where we're going to spend the night, how we're going to get from one spot to another. So there is a great deal of faith involved in what we're doing.
Let's go back for a moment to the founding of Gross National Happiness USA. Gross National Happiness is a concept that was that the thing that originated in Bhutan?
Yes. Yes. So the story that I like to tell about how we began, we have a colleague, Linda Wheatley. Also, we're from Central Vermont, as is Linda. And Linda had been in Bhutan at an international conference on gross national happiness. And there were something like 75 people there, and about five of them were from Vermont. So she came back to Vermont, and she was just, again, for her, it became a calling, just obsessed with the need to switch to this paradigm and away from, you know, the all-encompassing focus on money and materialism. And I met Linda by accident on a dirt road outside my home in rural Vermont. I had just read a book by Eric Weiner, a former NPR correspondent, who wrote a book called Geography of Bliss. And Eric Weiner had traveled to all these countries that were the happiest countries to see if there was a common thread, including Bhutan. He'd written about gross national happiness, and my response was, wow! I mean, I had an instant reaction that I just loved it. And about 2 weeks later, serendipitously, I ran into a woman who I had never met before, Linda Wheatley. We were just out taking walks, and she was obsessed with this and immediately started talking to me about GNH. And I said, whoa, I have to work with you. And so she was very focused on setting up the first conference in the United States on GNH, which we did in Burlington, Vermont. And then we said, but what's next? Don't we need an organization? So, and Linda and Paula already knew each other. So it was just a small group of us who felt really compelled by this concept.
So what does the concept mean, gross national happiness?
The idea is that material well-being certainly matters. And we hear about this a lot, you know, what's happening on Wall Street, our gross national product. These are statistics that get put out in front of us all the time. So then we become focused on, you know, creating, getting more stuff and getting, increasing our financial wealth. But gross national happiness is about all those other things that really make life worth living. And we know this, that life isn't all just about money. It tends to be where we put our focus. But there are these other things, such as our culture, our education, our psychological well-being, our community vitality, and on, that are as important as our standard of living.
But there's a couple of things I want to ask you about that. Because first of all, we live in a society right now where every single thing that you mentioned is monetized.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Doesn't it all come back to money? But it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. I mean, that's a made-up construct. So there's been a lot of research in positive psychology and what it is that really drives us as actual, you know, we're biological creatures, and there are things which push us and drive us, one of which is accomplishment. And this comes from Martin Seligman, the father of positive psychology, which often is translated to greed. So fine. We're greedy because we need to be for survival, but we do not need to be greedy for money. We do not need to be greedy for stuff. We can channel our natural instincts as humans. So both us as individuals and then how we come together in community and society. And we can focus instead on what actually would make for the most positive communities, systems, governments. We can be greedy, in other words, really for happiness.
The use of the word we is something that I want to ask about too. I think most people in the United States are not greedy for stuff. Most of the people in the United States are trying to survive. And this continual workaholism and having one, two, three jobs, or one person doing the job of one, two, three, four people. And when a company is downsized, people have to do more work than they did before for the same salary. The greed isn't theirs. It's the greed, if you want to call it that, on the part of the people who own those companies and who are trying to essentially exploit their employees in order to make more money. So there's a lot of greed at the top, which I think gets sort of projected onto ordinary citizens.
Well, it is true that we are working really hard just to survive. Many people are. There's another piece of this too. We were just talking to somebody this morning. In many of our interviews support this. People want to step out of that kind of rat race. You know, just trying to get by is not what we want on our tombstone at the end of the life.
No,
right?
I know. And that is exactly the thing, because you can't step out of it unless you don't want heat,
right?
Internet,
rats,
and things that basically, cell phone and things that are basically required for you to be a member of the society at all, not to mention taxes.
Here's the good news, that there are good examples, and we're hearing about them every day, of people stepping out. And there, for instance, is a co-housing situation here that we were privileged to stay in last night. So there's a moving towards a different way of living that we're hearing all the time. It's not that we don't know how to do this. We know how to move and shift towards our values, living our values. It's the will, and it's also changing the systems is what I think you're talking about. Yeah, I mean, no one said this was going to be easy, but we need to start taking action on an individual level and on a societal level to make that shift so that it does make it easier for people to live out their values. Again, a story that we heard recently is, and I think we've heard this all along, people actually sometimes leave the country because those systems get so much in the way. But other countries know how to do this. You know, other countries have people live more in balance with their lives. You know, and that is actually one of the domains of Gross National Happiness USA is time balance. You know, we don't want to be working three jobs just so that we can have a certain standard of living or afford health care.
Who is a good example of, like, a country that's living in balance?
It's, of course, hard to say from the outside, but Denmark appears to do a wonderful job. You know, there's another element that hasn't been brought up that, in fact, drives me personally and many people across this country, and that's the climate, which is crucial and which gets to another country that's really good. So the other thing that is so destructive about following just the GDP, the gross domestic product, the gross national product, using that as the paradigm and as the measurement, and you're true, it's true, it's not all of us, but it is what we hear all the time in the media, that GDP is up. You know, jobs, 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 money, 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 growth, growth, growth economy, which is in fact completely unsustainable. As long as we follow that paradigm, we are not doing what we need to do to, you know, save the human race, to do the climate action we need to do to pursue climate justice. So a really good example of a country that is particularly well balanced, so not just in terms of personal happiness and societal happiness, but also their relationship with the climate, is Costa Rica. So there's one measurement system that comes out of Britain called the Happy Planet Index, which I just love that name. So the Happy Planet Index looks at not only the well-being of the people in the country, but also what is their carbon footprint. So there are countries that rate fairly high in terms of overall well-being and happiness, but they also rate very high in terms of their carbon footprint.
Who would that be?
Well, the United States.
We rate high on happiness?
We're okay. You know, we're like 11th or 15th or something in the world. We're not at the top. But Costa Rica is both high in individual and societal well-being and happiness and very low in their carbon footprint. So it's not just how happy are we as communities and individuals, but it is what are we doing to save the planet? What are we doing in terms of our responsibility to future generations as well?
We're talking to Ginny Sassman and Paula Francis, happiness walkers. So you two and others as well founded Gross National Happiness USA, and the idea was to bring attention to these issues that you've been talking about, climate, how people live their lives, greed, money, what are the other values that people care about. What is the work of the organization like, besides the walk that you're doing, which I wouldn't want to talk more about, but what does Gross National Happiness do?
Basically, we want to make happiness our new bottom line. And so we are using the information from the walk and from other sources to influence policy so that when we are making decisions, whether it's on a local government basis or on a national, global, we are using measures and a matrix that considers all of these things that truly matter in life, so that we're not just making decisions based on what our financial bottom line will be. And this, by the way, is happening on a global level. The United Nations is very in support of sharing this new paradigm and trying to influence policy all around the globe.
And I would add to that in terms of what we're actually doing. And I think I mentioned, we really feel an urgency in this message and this mission. You know, more and more, there's a lot of ugliness and unhappiness. So a key element of what we're doing right now is educational. I think it's so important to let people know there are options. We don't have to go down one road. We can go down another road.
So let's look at those options. What do you mean specifically?
I mean, we can step aside from a lot of the GDP driving forces. We can say, I don't need to keep buying and shopping all the time. I can buy used. I can buy recycled. There are other ways that people are living. For example, we were walking through Louisiana, and we were in the Acadian district, which was very vibrant, but it was an area that people, you know, in their 50s, 60s, when they were children, it's a French-speaking area, and they were punished for speaking French. So what's happening there, there was one particular project of a fellow who bought an old potato barn to recreate a community center, a collaborative arts center, but also a place to bring people back to start speaking their French again, and trying to use the arts, to use their basic culture, to recreate their own local vibrant community so that, you know, less dependent on importing stuff and, you know, all the things which are damaging to the climate, damaging to our own personal pocketbooks, but finding creative, positive ways to just live differently. So there's a lot of work that's going to have to be done on the national level as well, and I think it's going to take a while to get there. But things like the income inequality that is just so dreadful in this country right now leads to a great deal of unhappiness for everybody.
So that's the thing. That's what's sort of interesting and paradoxical about this message. Income inequality, it's about money. It's about wealth. And on the one hand, you're saying income inequality causes unhappiness. On the other hand, you're saying money doesn't cause happiness. But it kind of does.
I'm so glad you asked that so we can be clearer. Money and stuff have an important role to play in all of our lives. However, we need a lot less than maybe people think we need. So one study showed that if you don't have enough to survive, you're not going to be very happy. If you don't have enough to pay for your health care, it's going to be a problem. But studies have shown that our happiness goes up according to our income and our material comfort to a certain point. And then it plateaus, and then it starts going down, that we're weighed down.
But that's a tiny percentage of people at the top. I mean, all the rest of us are in that place, which we haven't gotten to that point, right?
I'm not actually sure that's true, honestly. We may feel like it's true, but there is a lot of pressure on us to keep buying and keep accumulating all kinds of things that maybe we don't need to do. I know that's not true for a lot of people, and I bear in mind one woman who we met also in Louisiana, who was a single mom, two kids, working several jobs, and money didn't come out for her as the most important thing in her life, but she is working hard to have greater financial security so she can provide a better life for her children. So it's an aspect. It's part of what we need. But so is love and community and time and creativity. We're just way out of whack.
And we're not proposing that we build our happiness skills to the point where we're happy despite all these other things that are going on that cause suffering. You know, we are responsible for our own personal happiness for sure. And there are kind of happiness muscles that we can exercise so that we can achieve a certain level of higher level of personal happiness. But our organization, and Ginny and I, as we're walking, we're not saying, okay, let's pay attention to becoming more personally happy and allow these other things to kind of perpetuate in our society that cause harm or suffering. We think that our personal happiness is very much connected to societal happiness.
And vice versa. It's very symbiotic. So tell us more about your walk. Where did you start and what are some of the things that have happened along the way?
Well, that's a long story. It's a 3,400 mile long story.
That's how much you've gone so far?
Yes.
So far.
Yes, yes. Now, this hasn't been consecutively. It's been in legs.
But you started in Vermont.
Started in Vermont. It was only going to be a 7-week walk from Stowe, Vermont, down to Washington, D.C., to Jefferson Memorial, where it says the pursuit of happiness right there carved in the wall, and to talk to people along the way, you know, to share the message, a little education, but also to collect stories about what matters most, to make sure that we are paying attention to the right things, including people's voices, a diversity of voices. Well, that walk was so inspirational to us that we got the bug. First of all, the walking itself, being out in nature, being in the sun, you know, connecting, seeing life at 3 miles an hour is a real gift, you know, to slow down like that.
It's a gift even in your city. Like if you just walk around Santa Fe for a whole day, you see things that you drive by all the time and don't notice.
One of my favorite things to do on this walk is to walk into a city. You know, we're so used to just getting in a car or a bus or even flying into a city. But to walk into it is a totally different experience. And usually it's the bowels of the city that you walk into first. Because first of all, this is not a very pedestrian-friendly country, you know. So some of the roads that you can access cities from are not always the kindest in the most beautiful parts of the city. Usually it's by the dump, you know. So you get to experience things differently. You don't get to see things as a tourist. You know, that's not the point of all of this. So, but the point of this walk is the connection with people along the way. I talked about those little microbursts of love. You know, those things I think are also important to the people we're talking to. You know, to get people to stop and reflect on what matters in life. How often do we have these conversations with one another, really?
So tell us about some of these conversations. Like, how do you meet people and what happens then?
Well, we look a little maybe silly or different for sure. You know, we're walking and we're often, you know, very tired and sweaty. And we look carrying these big bags.
These middle-aged women.
But serious about happiness in our fluorescent vests. And so people are usually curious about us and approach us. Like, what are you doing? And what's the cause? You're not asking for money, are you? That's, you know, or this is not a religious thing, is it? And of course, the answer is no and no. And when they hear that we're walking around the country, it's, you know, their jaws drop to the floor. Like, you too? You or whoever is with us? Yeah. And that's kind of grabs people right there, their curiosity about what we're doing. When we ask that question about what matters most in life, it brings that conversation to a much different level. It's as though people go right from the head, boom, right down to their heart. And it is not an unusual occurrence where people will just start crying. And that, it happened this morning. We were talking to somebody. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One, when we reflect on what matters most in life, and if we see that our life really isn't aligned with that, there may be some sadness that comes along with that. And it seems to touch that place for some people.
Tell us more specifically some of these stories. Like, you say, hi, what matters to you most in life? And they start crying? Like, what?
Okay, so I'll go. This morning it was, what matters most in life are our relationships. And people say that over and over and over and over again. Now we're having all of this, these recordings, record what people have to say. We're having them analyzed.
You're recording them.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, we ask permission. And we'll have all of this data analyzed in a university back at home. But I don't think we need that data to know that a large percentage of people, maybe as much as 90, say relationships, family matter most. So we asked a woman this morning, and her son matters most in life. Our kids do, right? That makes sense. And that's a heartwarming place to sit right there, you know, with that love. Because really, when you think about what we're saying, and if you could water everything down to maybe one word, it would be love. Matters most.
So are you saying that when you meet people and ask them this, they realize it but they're out of touch with it?
They don't have enough time. We talked about how our time is all taken up with this, you know, trying just to get by. But when you stop and are present with that thought about what matters most in life, yeah, it's a very heartwarming place to be. There is another reason why people cry, and that is the joy of recognition of what matters most in life, you know?
But sometimes they are out of touch. We met a woman, and we never know where we're going to stay. Sometimes it is in motels. And we met a motel clerk, asked her, and she started to cry. And her story was that she said her husband. And she started to cry because she said, I don't tell him that enough. I don't share that. And she explained to us that she and her older child had been kind of trapped previously in a drug culture universe that was dangerous and destructive, and that her husband had helped pull them out of that. And that now she was working very hard. He was working very hard. But she said, I don't care. I would live in a cardboard box. I just want to be with my husband and my children. And her reflections on how much she was grateful to him and loved him and what he had done for them. So she was a little bit out of touch. And we saw her the next morning again, and she told us she had called him to tell him that. And so that was a very moving experience. I wanted to share, there's another way to look at how important this is to people, and that is how they take us into their personal lives. So we've had some really amazing experiences. I wasn't actually part of the walk at the beginning. I didn't get it until Paula and Linda were talking about all these amazing things. So the first time I joined them, it was a family with four children in Pennsylvania. And they fed us this wonderful dinner, drove us to where we needed to be to walk, and then said, please come back tomorrow. Please come back tomorrow. And the next day, which was a pouring down rain day, so it was not a great walking day. So I, as the newbie, was staggering with blisters up to their house. And so two of the children, they were 11-year-old twin girls, came flying out of the house and running down the lawn to leap into our arms with love. And they had spent the day making duct tape jewelry for us. They had presents for us. They gave us jewelry. Another really profound example of being brought into people's lives. We were staying with a woman who is a cancer survivor, and she had her cancer survivors group over for a big party. It was like a birthday party and then also to meet us. Well, they were grieving because they had just lost one of their lovely friends, Cecile. So our friend who we stayed with said, I really want you to know who Cecile was. So she took us the next night out to Cecile's little farm so that we could see Cecile's artwork everywhere and meet her grandchildren. And we had crackers and cheese and wine, and we all talked about Cecile and her meaning in their lives. It was just amazing. We were two strangers who had just met them 24 hours before, and here they were sharing their deep grief, their deep joy, their deep love. And I think that happens maybe for two reasons. Well, there's probably many. But one is we listen to people as much as possible without judgment, but certainly coming from a place of compassion, deep compassion, to listen to each person's story. I don't think that happens enough in our culture, so when people are listened to, they really respond. And I think the other is the message that people do really care about this. They care about this deeply, and it resonates. And so they open up their hearts and their homes and their lives to us. And I think that's a large part because of the message.
There is a bit of magic to this walk in so many different ways. And we get so much out of it. To connect Louisiana to Santa Fe in that same group of women who were cancer survivors, we got connected to a woman who then connected us to someplace else to stay. This is how it happens often. And we were staying with a woman in Texas who had a neighbor, 92 years old, an old vet, wonderful man, charming. And we made this connection. We're collecting friends along the way. We are so fortunate and lucky. And he told of the story of losing his son in the Vietnam War. And he doesn't travel much anymore. And he doesn't get out to Santa Fe where his son is buried. And he knew that I was coming here. So a couple of days ago, Ginny and I took a walk to the National Cemetery right here in Santa Fe. We're able to sit in front of his son's grave with a picture of him and take a photograph of the plot, and then send it back to this 92-year-old man in Texas. And so it's a circle of relationship that we have here.
And that whole sense of relationship, I think, is so crucial and so interesting. And hinges on this question of whether you trust strangers and in what context you trust strangers. I remember being in Cuba, but this is true in other places, I think in Latin America as well, where people call each other uncle and aunt and brother and sister to strangers because they feel that they're part of something greater. And I think that's become, well, I don't know that we ever had this because we're such a divided country and we're founded on racism and things like that. But here you are walking and complete strangers trust you because you're vulnerable, because you're listening, because you're walking for something that matters to them that you have in common.
One story to share, and we talk about the divisions, the race, the politics, the religion, regional differences. We don't talk about that. Other people will talk about it with us. But there was an experience, we were walking through Jacksonville, so we're two white women, walking through a largely African-American neighborhood, and we'd gotten caught in a thunderstorm. We were late. We were trying to meet somebody. So often we'll stop and talk to people along the way, but sometimes we don't have much time. And I had looked over. There were two young black men standing near us. And in what I was thinking was, should we stop and try to interview them? Oh, no, we don't have time. We're running late. We better keep going. So one of them, he'd seen me look. He'd seen that I was thinking something. He came over to me and said, "Ma'am, please don't be afraid of me. Please don't be afraid of me." I feel like I'm going to start to cry. It was quite a moment. And I said, no, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid of you. You know, we're walking for happiness. And he said again, "Please don't be afraid of me. Please don't be afraid of me. Not all black people are dangerous. Please don't be afraid of me." And I said, "I'm not afraid of you. Please don't think that all white people think that, because we don't." And I said, "We're walking for happiness." And he then said, "I'm going to tell you my real name." And my real name is, I think it was Orville. And he said, "Can I walk with you?" And we said, "Yes, walk with us." So he walked with us a couple of blocks. And then he said, "Bless you, bless you, bless you." And he went on his way. So it can cut across that stuff.
And it goes both ways. Yeah. You know, there are two questions that are very commonly asked when people hear that we're walking across or around the country. How many shoes have you gone through? That's like the number one question. The answer is 7, by the way, up to now. And the second one is, aren't you afraid? And no, we're not. We're not afraid. We put that out there. I think a lot of people do live their life in fear of all sorts of things. But something happened along the way where I realized, wow, people think that we're taking a risk, but really people are taking a risk on us as well. We met this one couple, and the woman automatically said, "Oh, stay with us, stay with us," and wrote down her address so that we could walk there. And learning later, the husband wasn't as thrilled with that idea as she was, because he didn't, you know, What were we going to do with their home? You know, could he trust us with the valuable things in their home? And I had never stopped to think that, wow, some people fear us. You know, who could fear us? We're, you know, middle-aged women, you know, that were walking. Yeah, but so it does cut across both ways. But that fear factor, I'll tell you, really gets in the way of a lot of living.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be one of the central pieces of American political discourse or underlying discourse in the moment we're living in.
And there was a story told of us. There were two beautiful young women with their babies, and they were telling a story about in their community, there was some white flight happening, right? So some people of color were coming into their neighborhood, so the white people would move out fearing who the other person was. A very wise person in their neighborhood said, "I'm not going to go for that. I'm going to have a free breakfast on my lawn every Saturday and invite everybody to come." Well, eventually people started showing up more and more and more. People got to know one another, and it just turned the whole feeling of the community around, and people felt connected. Connection is very, very important. So we need strategies, apparently, to get past that fear. And I just thought that was a lovely example of what one person can do.
We're talking to Paula Francis and Ginny Sassman about happiness, Gross National Happiness USA. Now, on this walk, you are interviewing people, recording the interviews. A documentary is being made.
Yeah.
A book is being written.
Two books.
Okay. Tell us about that.
The two books. So we're writing different books about our experiences on the walk. The documentary, there is a filmmaker in Vermont who perhaps folks in Santa Fe won't know, but highly, highly regarded in Vermont, a woman named Bess O'Brien, who's done a lot of award-winning documentaries on some tough subjects like bulimia and the foster care system. And so she is working on doing now a documentary, both about the walk and critically, I think, about the walk as an aspect of the overall Gross National Happiness push and effort.
There's Bess O'Brien back in Vermont who is interested in doing a documentary about this walk. But the thing about this walk that we didn't mention is that it's really about positivity, not negativity, not the things that are seriously not going in the right direction, but it's what we can build that is right and good and that will lift up the goodness of life and point us in a different direction. So because Bess has been so involved in all these issues that really are hard-hitting, she was very interested in the flip side of that, which is what we are interested in. What are the underlying causes of wellness? What are the underlying causes of happiness? And what are the strategies that we can utilize to build those and create this life that we want to live? So we're very excited about this, and it will be in part about the walk, but it will also be talking about this overarching mission of Gross National Happiness USA.
And what are those causes of wellness and happiness?
Well, one of the things I often think about is, you know, floating out there on the internet, those memes that we see, and it's a cliche and a meme that says happiness is an inside job. So that is true to an extent, but happiness is also an outside job. Those systems we were talking about earlier. So the personal happiness, one of the things that I think many people don't even realize is that it is a choice. That and there are, with the whole positive psychology movement, more and more research on what it is that does actually create personal happiness. How do we build our resilience? Paul has mentioned the microbursts of love several times. So that actually comes from a brilliant researcher in North Carolina named Barbara Fredrickson, who studies positivity and its actual, the physiology, what we're experiencing in and how it is expressed in our genes. So it's a whole science of what we really can do to greatly increase our personal happiness that then can radiate out to create greater happiness and well-being with the people around us. People sometimes will ask me, isn't happiness indulgent? Personal happiness, isn't it indulgent? Isn't it selfish? And to me, certainly there's an element of that, but I also think it's one of the least selfish things we can do, because the more our hearts and lives are filled with really grounded in reality, deep well-being, thriving, and happiness, the better able we are to do whatever it is we do in life, whether that's parenting, whether that's whatever our work is, even as we proceed in life, how we treat other people. You know, are we mean to people and add to their bad day, or are we kind to them? We are finding that many people are lonely. The author of there's a big Harvard longitudinal survey that's been going on many, many years, and he has said the opposite of happiness is loneliness. So love, connection, huge. But, you know, one thing that is accessible to almost everybody, that almost anybody can do this, is to have some form of a mindfulness or meditation practice. And, you know, that's been connected with, maybe that's an Eastern religion, maybe that's not mine, maybe that's too hard, maybe, you know, and in fact, it's a practice that anybody can do. You don't need to attach religion or spirituality to it. And all of the studies on what really leads to thriving resilience and better lives, a mindfulness practice of some sort is on every list in the top one or two or three things to do. And even if it's just pausing during the day to take three deep breaths. So that's the one thing that I would say everybody, including, they're doing this with little children. They're teaching children loving kindness meditation and compassion meditation, and it's showing up as helping them do much better in their schoolwork. So that's one tool.
It sounds like it's a lot about being in the present and noticing what's in front of you, as opposed to thinking about the future or your to-do list or whatever.
It's noticing what's within you. Are you needlessly stressed, which is certainly true in our society, that people are often needlessly stressed. And it's also being more aware of other people. Are you, you know, how are they doing?
You have an initiative here in Santa Fe. What's that all about?
So I mentioned earlier that one of the things that we feel we need to do is educate as many people as possible. Another piece that we find on the walk is people want to be involved. How can I be part of this? How can I be engaged? So we are launching here something that we're calling the Charter for Happiness. And it's a simple document that lists both, here's what's happening on the systems level, including the work at the United Nations. Here's what we know about personal level happiness and what could be done to help individuals and communities, and people can sign on. So we are, we talked with the farmers market, and we are highly, highly likely to be at the farmers market this Saturday with a booth. We will be unveiling the charter for the first time here, and people can sign it, and it will also be online. So, you know, our hope is that we can collect, you know, many thousands, millions of signatures over a period of years, because we know this is a long-term effort. This is not something that's going to happen quickly.
And of course, a huge piece of what we're doing is to inspire action. That is our ultimate hope, is that people not only get educated, but act on the information that they have. So either change their life in some personal way to benefit their community, their family even, in a positive way to grow happiness and well-being, or even on a national or global scale. So that's part of also what we're asking through the charter, is a commitment to pay attention to these things in your personal life, and also to figure out ways that we can do even more because of the urgency that we feel.
Paula Francis and Ginny Sassman are co-founders of Gross National Happiness USA. They're walking across the United States, are in Santa Fe this week. You can find out more at gnhusa.org and happinesswalk.com. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.